Steve Jones is a rapscallion. He tells tall stories. He's having fun, as he should given his eminence at the University College in London, where he's Professor of Genetics. His latest book is called The Serpent's Promise, The Bible Retold as Science, and he gives a clue about what Liz Colbert was referring to at the end just now. Your book is called The Serpent's Promise. Now, what was the serpent's promise?
Well, it's the serpent's promise to Eve. I've just been in New Zealand, which is, New Zealanders believe, as close as you can get to the Garden of Eden in this modern world.
I agree with them.
Of course, what happened was, in the original Garden of Eden, a serpent appeared. It was clearly an Australian import, and offered this alien fruit to Adam and Eve. And the promise it made, the serpent made to Eve, and I'll translate the Latin, was, if you eat of this fruit, ye shall be as gods, knowing of good and evil. And so she ate of the fruit, and they became knowing of good and evil. What was the first thing they noticed? Well, the first thing they noticed meant that they had to put aprons on immediately. So that's when sex began. That's when all the troubles began. And they were thrown out into the real world, or into Australia, which is approaches closely to the real world. And that word scientia is at the center of my book, Knowledge.
Knowledge,
knowledge,
yes.
Was scientia.
That was the promise.
And that was the promise. You will get knowledge. And of course, science gives us knowledge. In some senses, if you want to be overdramatic about it, it gives us, at least genetics gives us, knowledge of good and evil, because the sin of Adam and Eve loaded us all with original sin, with inborn failures and weaknesses, which we either can, according to some religions, or cannot, according to others, do something about. That's what DNA does, of course. You can now scan people's genes, and you can ask questions. Is it the case? And it does indeed seem to be the case. Are there genes that vary from person to person that make somebody perhaps more likely to be violent under certain circumstances? And I would say the evidence is quite strong that there are. And that's a scientific issue. But the interesting point then is, what do you do with the scientific information? Then it becomes a theological issue or a philosophical issue. You see that most of all in a really very grisly field, which I'm passionately opposed to, which is the issue of the death penalty in the United States. There have been cases in the US where murderers, people who are clearly guilty, and have often done it under the most vicious circumstances, have appealed against the death penalty on the grounds that they had some inherited defect that made it impossible for them to control their rage and their anger.
A sort of biological original sin.
Yes, it is a biological original sin. Now, I think to you and I, and perhaps no doubt to the majority of your audience, that would seem a reasonable argument. I wasn't possessed by gods, as he were in the old days. I was possessed by the double helix, okay? Please forgive me. Shrive me of my sin. And in general, I have to say that doesn't work as an argument. It hasn't worked. The state of Georgia, when that argument began to be used, for state president, what was his name? George W. Bush, I'm not sure what became of him, immediately changed its laws about the death penalty to say that anybody who poses a continuing threat to society shall be subject to the death penalty. So what that means is, if you say, I've got this gene that made me do it, off you go to the death chamber. Now, I hate that idea, but I have to say that the logic of kill me is as strong as the logic of forgive me. And science can't interfere in that argument. And that's, I think, what an awful lot of the religious people who've complained about my book, and take it from me, there have been lots of them.
I've read them, yeah.
Don't see is that there is a limit to science. Science produces facts. What you do with that fact is a matter for society.
Let me just quote you A.C. Grayling, the philosopher who you know, I think.
Yeah.
And he said that science and religion have the same origin, ignorance.
I would be a little bit more positive and say curiosity, because I think, I'm sure, that we are the only creature that know that we are ignorant. That's, I think, is central to the human condition, is curiosity, to find why does this happen? Why are there men and women? Why is there death? And these are the questions which, of course, the good book asks. There's a spin-off from that statement, which is perhaps my favourite quote from Darwin, and I can bore you for hours with favourite quotes from Darwin, as I'm sure you can. Darwin, in a letter to somebody criticising another piece of work, said, ignorance is more often a cause of confidence than is knowledge. Now, that's a very powerful statement. That should be tattooed on the forehead of every geneticist, if not every scientist. If you don't know what you're talking about, you can be completely certain that you're right. And the history of genetics is exactly that. Francis Galton, who was Darwin's cousin, wrote a book about hereditary genius in which he became convinced, with no evidence whatsoever, that people, the genius, crime, and all these things were in the genes, in the DNA, as we'd say today. And that led to the horrors of the eugenics movement, which did dreadful things with complete ignorance. Now, I think in my science, and I hope in other sciences, at least we understand that we're ignorant. And in genetics, we're much more ignorant than we were 10 years ago. It's much, much more complex than we ever thought. And I look forward to the headline, I hope in my lifetime, DNA is not the genetic material. We aren't quite there yet, but it turns out that DNA is just one small part of an astonishingly complicated machine that we scarcely understand. So I hope that geneticists will stop blathering about their science. I won't, but I hope the rest of them do.
Yes, indeed. Let me hit you with another quotation, which is in your book. It's Napoleon talking about the function of religion. What did he say about the rich and the poor? That religion is what stops the poor from killing the rich.
Yes, that's right. He said that religion is what stops the poor from killing the rich, and that's one of the models of the origin of religion. But he also read a book by Laplace, a great mathematician, about the universe. And I tried reading it, and it's heavy going, I can tell you. And he said to Laplace, why is there no mention of God in this book? And Laplace said something which is very important, precious to me. I have no need of that hypothesis. Saying that God did this doesn't add anything to the argument, okay? And I think Napoleon's later statement about that religion is the only thing that stops the poor killing the rich is a matter of observation. There is a science, a stronger science than you might think, actually, which again I knew nothing about, which looks at the science of religion. Why do we have this strange thing?
Indeed, that's what I wanted to ask you, the evolutionary significance, because even though you say that religion is here and there and somewhere else, it's virtually everywhere.
Yes, it's virtually everywhere. You can say with great confidence, when the kind of religion which is powerful, with a God that's up there, that scrutinizes one's every move every day, when did that begin? That began quite certainly with the origin of farming. Okay, and you can see early cities in the very first days of farming, much earlier than people had thought, actually, which are replete with symbols and with temples, and that reflects, without question, the development of social class.
But what about the hunter-gatherers? What about, you know, if you look at primitive societies, they had totems, they had witch doctors, they had people doing ceremonies, they buried their dead with ornaments?
Yes, they did, to a much lesser degree. In fact, what you find is that many hunter-gatherer societies do have a belief in a god, there's no question of that, but it's much less specific belief. The god is up there, but it's not really interested in them. There is a god that causes thunder, there's a god that causes the sun to rise, but is not intimately concerned with their sex lives, that they've been to church three times on a Sunday, that they have to pay their tithes, all this kind of stuff. Those kind of socially powerful religions begin with inequality, and that's true across the world. There are enormous differences from place to place in the proportion of people who claim to be religious. And there's an almost uncanny fit between a particular measure, which is called the Gini Index, which is a measure of inequality. How flat is the income distribution? It's very, the inequality is very high, let's say, in the United States. It's much lower in places like, say, Finland. Across the world, in every continent, within the United States, in every state, there is a linear direct relationship. The more unequal a society, the more religious it is. Now, I can't help thinking that's trying to tell us something.
It's to keep the peasants under control.
That's one view. A more optimistic view is that it's to draw people together in order that they stop fighting among themselves. And there is some evidence that that has happened in some circumstances. Religious communes tend to last much longer than non-religious communes. So the problem isn't necessarily religion. The problem, and it's an overwhelming one, and always has been, is religions.
Plural.
Because once you've got these warring groups, then everything falls apart. And that's the history of history, is groups with different mindsets. I say, perhaps rather daringly, I believe it, many people despise the notion, that actually we're on the edge of a new global universal system of thought. It's not a religion. Some people might say it is a religion, but it's called science. And the science I do is the same as a science a Chinese person does or a South American does. And you see that in science. It's a completely open exchange of ideas. You will never, ever see that in religion.
In religion, you have to have things without doubt. You know, this is the catechism. This is what's right. this is the law. Well, whereas in science, you're changing the laws all the time.
Yes. There are doubts, but the doubts are thrown in, you know, they grease the wheels of religion. You're allowed to have a few doubts, but too many doubts, you're out of the religion or you're being burned at the stake.
Instead of being infallible, the Pope is less fallible.
Yes. If I had the desire, as every scientist, of course, does, to start learning Norwegian, in other words, to win the Nobel Prize, what would I do? The only way I could win the Nobel Prize would be to prove that evolution never happened. Okay. Now, I don't think I'll ever do that because the evidence is overwhelming that evolution did happen. But there is a possibility that that could take place. It took place more or less in physics in 1904 when the then president of the Royal Society said to the mass physicists, give up doing physics. You've done it.
It's over. It's done.
It's over. It's done. It's finished. Okay. 1905, relativity, quantum theory. The whole of physics, one level, fell apart completely surprisingly. And no religious person could countenance that. And that's the difference. Science is for pessimists. Religion is for optimists. And I, being Welsh, have always been a pessimist.
Final question, something that was thrown at Richard Dawkins after he wrote The God Delusion and various other people who've put science and religion together. Were you accused violently of not knowing your theology and therefore getting it all wrong?
Yes, again and again. And I put my hands up, you're right, Gov, I don't know your theology. I've tried to read it and a dark mist comes before my eyes and I can't understand a word of it. My response to that argument is, if you read my book, and if you don't like it, burn it, but at least pay for it first.
Exactly. Well, the trouble with that sort of argument, you don't know your theology, it's an unlimited accusation. There is no way you can ever know enough.
Well, the same is true of science. I mean, Darwin was more or less the last person to know everything about biology. Milton, perhaps, was the last person to know everything about everything. I don't think anybody could know everything even about cell biology today. So it's got bigger and bigger. I think, you know, science has got, I hope, is more humble than it used to be.
Thank you, Steve Jones.
Thank you.
The Serpent's Promise is the book, published by Little Brown, and Steve Jones is at the University College in London, Professor of Genetics. A longer version of that chat is on RNTV. Do watch. There's a link on the Science Show website. Next week, Citizen Science, The Present Revolution. Production by David Fisher and Russell Stapleton. I'm Robin Williams.
Imagine a world where you can just print off a brand new leg. Well, you can't do it yet. But this week on Download This Show, we're seeing just how far away we are with the world of biofabrication. Plus, he was one of the creative driving forces behind Reddit, RSS, an activist, and to some, a hero, until it all ended at the age of 26. The life and the legacy of Aaron Swartz. That's Download This Show with me, Mark Fennell. And if you head to the RN website right now, you can do just that.